So all of our Thrive Talks this year are focusing on wisdom, and I'm doing a talk on wisdom for wives, and Rachel is going to go right after me and do a talk on wisdom for moms, so you're getting a doubleheader today, which is pretty exciting. I'm going to just start with saying you should go and buy Becca Merkel's book, Eve in Exile. It's fantastic. It's a great overview of godly femininity, and I think you'd be really encouraged by reading it, so please do. My talk is going to focus on our tasks as Christians and specifically as wives, and I'm going to use faithful women in our history as examples. So let's start with Genesis. In Genesis 1:28, God says to Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the earth." This is often referred to as the cultural mandate, because in it, God is commanding us to build families and cities, churches, governments, to subdue creation, studying science, art, architecture, all those sorts of things. In short, our job is to build cultures. That's what God has given us to do. After God gave the cultural mandate, he tells us that Eve is a helper to Adam. In Genesis 2:18, God says, Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper for him." Another word for helper is helpmeet. It's someone who takes intelligent part in her husband's pursuits. She's the husband's counterpart. She's on hand. She's nearby. She's ready to be a help and a comfort. So we know our task as wives is to fill the earth and subdue it with our husbands, to join them in their tasks. We've all read Genesis 3, so we know that that task is hindered by the enmity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. So while we are fulfilling and subduing, we have to fight the enemy. In our culture, as you must know, the reactions to this idea of a helpmeet range from disbelief to just outright scorn. And so we can be discouraged by that. And we're not the first to face these kinds of reactions. So I think it's helpful to look back at history and see some other ladies that have struggled with this. So here we are in the in the 12th century, the Catholic Church, way back when, and it might have even been the 11th century, but anyway, they ruled that priests couldn't marry. And so for the next 400 years, married couples were kind of second-class citizens in the world of holiness. The church said that truly holy people would be priests, monks, nuns, the clergy. Celibacy was the ideal. So despite what the church taught, that didn't work out so well. The priests at the time of the Reformation, at least, were they had concubines. They had children, which was fine with the church, even though it wasn't the ideal, because the bishops would assign a tax to them, a punitive tax based on your concubines or your children. So it's a money-making opportunity, which is, you know, you can see how that, that's how that worked. But the church was narrowly defining a vocation as someone who was involved in full-time Christian work. What that meant for the average person is that they could never truly glorify God, which is an oppressive idea. In the 16th century, we all know, Martin Luther came along, and he started saying that all vocations, even secular ones, could glorify God, that God uses those to accomplish his purposes in the world. He said a woman could have a vocation as a wife and a mother, and that this was a holy calling. And I think sometimes it can be hard to imagine how liberating that would be for women to suddenly feel like, what I'm doing is holy. It's not just, well, somebody's got to. He said a wife's, and this is a quote, "help and obedience to her husband were truly golden and noble works." So these women were no longer secondary citizens or less holy. The wives of reformers in particular paved a new way because they were the first pastors' wives. And they were no strangers to criticism. Of course, what was the example was if a priest had a woman, it was a concubine. So everyone kind of said, yeah, of course you're getting married. And you're kind of a bad person for doing it. They even said that a child of an ex-monk and an ex-nun, like Martin Luther and his wife, would be the Antichrist. So that wasn't so great. And their husbands were constantly under threat of martyrdom. There were a lot of people that wanted to kill these reformers. So it was hard, and it was glorious, and they had a lot of work to do. they were managing households. They were showing hospitality. There was one woman who all these men had been evicted from where for being faithful. And she took in 60 refugees, and she fed them for 3 weeks. That's just a lot of work. But that's what they needed to do to be faithful in that time. So they helped with hospitals and orphanages and schools, and they basically advanced the mission of the church. Their homes were the cultural and intellectual and social centers of their communities. Obviously, they didn't have church buildings, right, because they had just sort of separated from the church. So where are they going to meet? Where are they going to share these ideas? That's going to be in their homes. It was hard. You can imagine it, but it was glorious. So what's the point of looking at that? Well, we have a similar situation in our day. The world says that the only way to be holy, the only way to make a difference, the only way to really change the world is to have a career and to focus on that career. And you can't have a successful life if you're prioritizing your home. That's what we're hearing all the time. But that's tragic, because that's what God calls us to do, is to prioritize our homes. Martin Luther has a quote that, something he said at the time of the Reformation, and I think it applies particularly to us. What then does the Christian faith say to this? It opens its eyes. It looks upon all these insignificant, distasteful, and despised duties in the spirit, and is aware that they are all adorned with divine approval, as with the costliest gold and jewels. God with all his angels and creatures is smiling, not because of the washing of the diapers, but because it's done in Christian faith. So our job in our generation is to be like Martin Luther was on this subject. We have liberty in Christ. We are free to fulfill our calling as wives and mothers. And the rest of the world looks on with contempt, but at the same time, they really do wish for a fulfilling life. That's what they're aiming for. They're just aiming the wrong direction. So how did these women in the Reformation and those who came afterward specifically use their vocations to change history? Obviously, I touched on that, but a couple of ladies that we can look at particularly. Katie Nunn, Luther, was an ex-nun who married Martin Luther. She managed the house. They had a lot of guests. They had boarders. They had a small income. She raised orphans. She had 6 children of her own. One of them passed away pretty early. She took in sick townspeople when the plague arrived. She fed Martin Luther so well that his health improved. She taught him to garden. She made tasty beer. Which was great. She would sometimes have 120 people at her table, and that is how the Reformation spread. These people would come. They would listen to what Martin Luther was saying, and they would take that back to where they came from. So this was a great work that God had for her. Sarah Edwards is another really good example. She was married to Jonathan Edwards. I'm sure you all know he was an 18th century preacher and theologian. They had 11 children. He would work 13 hours a day. So she would manage the farm. She would manage the household. She would homeschool some of their children. And also they regularly had visiting ministers that would come and stay with them. One of them, Samuel Hopkins, said of her that she uniformly paid a becoming deference to her husband. She treated him with entire respect. She spared no pains in conforming to his inclination and rendering everything in the family agreeable and pleasant. She accounted it her greatest glory, and there wherein she could serve God and her generation to be the means in this way of promoting his usefulness and happiness. So George Whitefield was another person who stayed with them, and after he stayed, he thought, she's a great deal. I should get a wife. And about a year later, God gave him a wife. So that's really good. Charles Spurgeon was another. He's a 19th century preacher. I'm sure you've all read his works. And he said in a letter to his wife, "In all I've ever done for God, you have a large share. For in making me so happy, you have fitted me for service. I have served the Lord far more and never less for your sweet companionship." So being a helpmeet is not necessarily glamorous, but that doesn't mean it isn't momentous. John Piper has a great quote about Sarah Edwards, and I think it's true of so many others. She gave us a gift as she freed up her husband to do his calling. So these are obviously encouraging examples to follow, but the question is how to do it. I'm going to remind you of 6 biblical principles for wives, but I don't think you should think of them as like tips for living happily ever after. Maybe not. These are weapons that God is using to fight the culture of death around us. At the same time, they're tools that God is using to build a faithful people and a faithful culture. So doing these little things that seem insignificant are how we subdue the earth. And everything I'm going to say is easy to say and hard to do. In fact, it's impossible to do apart from God's grace. So, but because being a godly wife is powerful and glorious and subversive, you should expect that the world is going to hate it in the same way that the corrupted Catholic Church hated the way Martin Luther glorified ordinary vocations. We have a full court press in our culture against the Bible's teaching on this subject. So we need to be leaning into what the Word says, focusing on the Word and on our mission, and encouraging one another. So, onward. The first principle is be wise. I think that's pretty obvious, but Nancy did a great job on her talk with that, so I'm not going to elaborate. Just to say, you can't be a wise wife if you're not a wise woman. So fear the Lord, turn from evil. Next, work hard physically. Proverbs tells us that she looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. My dad had an executive minister at a fairly large church one time, and his wife was not an invalid in any way, and their children were all grown, but she would call every day, "Can you come home? Can you come home and help me? Can you come home and just keep me company?" And I think her husband did that enough that he didn't really work out as an employee. So that's maybe not a good idea. Be a hard worker. That woman managed to sabotage her husband's job because she always wanted help. So we should expect that the bigger our households get, the harder our jobs are going to get. Sorry. Sounds sad, but it's not discouraging, because at the same time, God gives more grace. God is always faithful to provide for us in whatever we need. But all of our difficulties now are part of our training program. They're getting us ready for the next big work that God has for us to do. I think a lot of moms with a lot of kids would say, oh, one baby would be such a breeze. But at the time when there was just one baby, it felt like that is every minute of my day. What else could I do? And that's how God works. He's always stretching us. He's always growing us. He's preparing us for something bigger and greater for us to do next. We want to be growing into more and more responsibility. The next thing is work hard mentally. And before I elaborate, I just want to say I understand that there are stages of life where an intellectual feat would be remembering your children's name at the end of the day. And that's true. But when you look at your entire life, you want it to be characterized by mental diligence, even if that particular day was not your shining moment. So Francis Fukuyama recently said at Valerie's wedding, he said, "Keep your mind sharp so you can sharpen his." You want to be the iron that sharpens iron. We want to study and learn. Remember, we have a mandate together with our husbands that we are, and the rest of the Christian church, we are supposed to be subduing the earth. And that means we're going to have to learn a lot. Many of the women at the Reformation were actually known for how conscientiously they were studying and applying their Bibles. Becca also makes a fantastic point in her book. She says, Paul doesn't say women aren't supposed to learn theology. He says they're not supposed to preach it from the pulpit. But he expects them to be learning it at home. So you don't preach from a pulpit, but you should be preaching your theology through your food, through your childbirth, through clothing, through all the things that you do. And that means you're going to have to know that theology and learn it. You can only really export what you import. So the more you grow in knowledge, the more capable you are of taking that knowledge and making it beautiful. And that's really the point. Third, submit to your husband. I don't think that there's anybody here that doesn't know this, but it's always a good reminder. I need it. I feel like you do too. As wives, we submit as Christ submitted to the Father. So remember that submission is a weapon. It glorifies God, and God blesses it. It's not just a point in time. It's a demeanor. It's a disposition. When I was in college, or my brother was in college, my younger brother, my parents were approached, my dad was approached by a church in Hong Kong to be their pastor. And my mom was so not interested in going. They'd always lived in the southern U.S. They'd always lived in the U.S. She never wanted to live in Asia. She didn't even like Chinese food. But she said, that's fine. If your dad says it's obedient to go, we're going. So she got on the plane, and they went. And she didn't I think sometimes this can be a temptation where, yes, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, but I'm standing up on the inside. And she did not just go mournfully. She went and she taught Bible studies, and she taught Sunday school, and she worked 30 or 40 hours a week, just volunteered, doing things for the church, trying to make Dad's ministry fruitful there. And they went from having about 200 people when they got there to more than 700 people in the church when they left. And most of them were these crazy, dramatic conversions. Like, I walked by a church door and felt this Holy Spirit, which was just... And they would all tell these amazing stories. Obviously, that was a huge blessing for them to be there, but it required obedience, it required trust, even though it maybe wasn't what she wanted to do. Sometimes that's the case. Your husband wants to do something and you don't want to do it, or he wants to take a risk and you think, no way. But just know that God is watching your obedience. You're answering to him. He is blessing you. He is faithful, and he always has your best in mind. Obviously, I just want to say, if your husband's asking you to sin, please don't do it. The next one, respect your husband. When I was in college, I went to a rehearsal dinner, and the mom's really sweet lady, and she says to the bride, I've always been his biggest cheerleader, but now you're going to be his biggest cheerleader. It was really sweet. So be a cheerleader. Speak well of your husband and respect him. I think a good start is to actually know what he does. For wives and mothers, you know, our vocation is oriented towards our people, our husbands, our children, our homes. But a man's vocation is oriented toward the world. So we should know, his vocation is very important to him. We should know what that is, and we should honor and respect him by knowing what it is. Obviously, you're not going to take his job, so you don't actually have to be an expert, but you could know something about it. There was a lady in a church that we were in Texas, and her husband was a cardiologist. And she was this fun, bubbly, chatty person, always super happy. And her husband was silent as the grave. And one time they went on a trip, and it was a car trip. She just timed him. How long would he go without talking? And it was so long. So she decided, well, I need to have something to talk to him about, and I'd like to learn about his world. So she read medical textbooks. Which, I'm not saying we all have to do that, but it was a great way to honor her husband and have something, be involved in his work. So the other important thing is just know what success looks like. You know, if your husband's a builder and he builds shelves in someone's basement or something, you can say, thank you, that was great. But if he builds a 40-foot tall round tower, you maybe should know that was way more impressive than the shelves in the basement. It's good to say, good job. That's amazing. You want to recognize his achievements and thank him for them. Back to our little history. Faithful wives throughout history have returned a prophet and honored their husbands in that way and have respected their husbands that way. There was a duchess in the 13th century in Hungary. Her husband was off at war on a military campaign, and famine struck. So all the townspeople started coming to the castle and looking for food, and she ended up feeding like 900 of them a day. And what she did is she took all the royal funds, she took her husband's resources and strengthened his kingdom and served the poor, which was a real blessing. Back to Charles Spurgeon and his wife. His wife's name was Susanna, and Susanna had twins and was debilitated afterwards. She was a semi-invalid after that. Prior to having the twins, she'd been really involved in taking an active role in Spurgeon's ministry. So she couldn't do as much at that point. And Spurgeon wrote a book, his first volume of letters to my students, I think that lectures to my students. And she read it, Susanna read it, and she said, well, everybody in England should have this, every minister in England. And Spurgeon said, well, then why not you? How are you going to do it? Go ahead. And so she said, okay. So she remembered, well, I've saved some of my little household expenses, and I could save some more. And over the course of her lifetime, she had a book fund that gave away 200,000 of her husband's books. That's a lot. And all in a way that honored her husband and blessed his ministry, drew a profit on his ministry. So we want to do those kinds of things. The fifth principle, encourage him. Start by praying for him. Ask how you can pray for him, specifically for the work he has in front of him. We want husbands who are faithful, who are diligent and successful and wise. And if you think about it, who else is praying for him? His mom, you. So it's a good thing. Hot meal, the kind words. We all know these are a big source of encouragement, I think, especially for guys, a hot meal. Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. That's from Proverbs. Things are really rough at work, and sometimes they are. Thank God for it and encourage him with faithfulness. Your home should be a refuge. Martin Luther said, let the wife make her husband glad to come home. And that's what you want to do. Also encourage him with wise counsel when he asks for it. Be a prudent wife whose words are like apples of gold and settings of silver. A prudent wife is from the Lord. But whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but a companion of fools will suffer harm. Obviously from Proverbs, you don't want your husband to be a companion of a fool. So be wise. When he asks for input and when you give it graciously, it can be such a blessing. Everyone, most people, appreciate if someone says, hey, you're going to drive off a cliff. But nobody wants a backseat driver for life. So you want to offer kind and wise input. And last, and this will probably seem kind of obvious, but don't sin together. You don't want to encourage him to sin. I have a friend whose mom would always say, don't hand him that apple, honey. And we have a lot of ways that we can do that. You can grow bitter at him, and this one is a tricky one, I think. You can grow bitter on his behalf. And it can seem like respect if you're growing bitter, angry, or annoyed with someone on his behalf, but it's not. Because now he's got this situation that's a problem. He's got his own temptations, and he's got your sin to deal with. So you've compounded the problem instead of helping him out of the problem. If he is in sin, don't join. You answer to God. You know that. And you know all the things I'm telling you, really. But they're just reminders. I'm sure a lot of you have heard these stories, but Katie Luther, Martin Luther's wife, sometimes had some problems on her hands. Martin Luther was at times pretty moody, and he could get a little bit grumpy. One time he was, for days, wouldn't speak to her. None of her counsel helped. He was just stomping around everywhere. And so finally she got on a black dress, a black veil, and she sat on a stool in the middle of the room, and he walked in and he said, what is wrong with you, woman? And she said, God is dead. And he said, God is not dead. What are you talking about? And she said, the way you've been acting, I was sure God was dead, so I just decided I would join you in mourning for him. And he snapped out of it. It's like, oh, yes, you're right. You're right. And there was another time where he went to his study for 3 days, and he would not come out. And remember I said, like, there's all these people coming to their house, wanting to have dinner, wanting to hear all these things that he had to say, and she has all these children and everybody else's children. And so finally she just called the village woodworker and she said, come take the hinges off the door. And so he did. And there she walked right in. Hi. So, you know, don't join him if he's sinning. Obviously, on a slightly more serious note, there are a lot of women whose husbands, especially during the time of the Reformation, their husbands were very opposed to their faith. There were men who were in power, and they're in the governments, and their governments would be colluding with the Catholic Church. There's one woman who even said, my husband persecutes Christ in me. But she also said, I will not disobey God, though it cost my neck 1,000 times. And I think that's just a great reminder. We answer to God, we obey him, and he blesses it, regardless of what's happening around us. So there you go. That's it. Principles, weapons, tools for wise wives. Seek wisdom, work hard, submit to your husband, respect him, encourage him in godliness, and don't sin together. These are all reminders. You all know them all already, and they're easy to say, but you're going to spend a lifetime doing it. So just remember, though, that whatever you do in faith, God sees it, and he knows, and he blesses it. That's what God is like. He always takes our little pieces of obedience and grows something great out of them, and he gets all the glory for it. Remember that, you know, 500 years ago at the time of the Reformation, all these ordinary women were just helping their husbands. They were obeying God. They were taking care of their kids, and they were faithful. And God used that God, in fact, there was one person that noted, you know, the Reformation could never have spread if these women who weren't writing theological treatises hadn't been welcoming people into their homes, hadn't been such an embodiment of what their husbands were teaching and what these reformers were teaching. So remember, their obedience was a gift to us, and we want to give future generations the gift of our obedience. Know that God can take that, and he can use it to destroy this culture of death that we see around us, and he can raise up a culture of life. And so be encouraged. You have a great job to do, even though it seems so minuscule, it is actually of eternal importance. So, thank you. And now, Rachel is going to come talk to you about wisdom for moms, and I think you all know Rachel, so you are excited to hear what she has to say.